Welcome to episode 507. If you keep putting your health and fitness on the I'll deal with it later pile, let me ask you this. Can you imagine needing to learn to read, write, and walk again because you never really had time to get healthy? Today's guest never quite got around to it and almost died on the side of a mountain, literally. Stress nearly put him in the ground permanently. In fact, he died twice. And so today's podcast is about the mindset and the values that you need to have before death comes knocking so you actually get through it. We also talk about his near-death experience, what actually happened that day, how he survived it, what it means to be a man, how to break free from the overwhelming sense of responsibility as a man providing for a family, and all of the other ideals that come about when you're a man in the world trying to figure out how to navigate the space between your ears. Get ready to feel all the feels in this one. It's a roller coaster. But without further ado, let's get into it. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Matty Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me. And now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? I want you to meet Warwick Bidwell, whom I actually kind of know through the business world, funnily enough, and through coaching programs in that realm of existence. And not too long ago, he had a podcast himself, and I got to hang out on that and have a bit of a chat. And so I wanted to get him on here because he's had some massive experiences in the last couple of years, and I think that they'd be relevant to people listening to this show. So, Warwick, mate, you've been on one hell of a journey. How you doing?
Hey, Matty. I never am quite sure how to answer that question these days when people ask me, oh, how you going, Woz, which is my nickname, obviously. And I think, ooh, how am I going? There's been a bit going on, as you've mentioned, Matty. So honestly, I'm going great is the short answer. I'm not prone to short answers, so feel free to cut me off. I'll probably become clearer to your listeners as to perhaps why my answers have become a bit longer to questions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just before we hit record, you showed me this T-shirt that you're wearing called And I'm Back. And so I think that sort of frames where we're going to go with this a little bit. But, I mean, what happened? Like, what? Tell us the big event that shaped this, I guess, that brought this conversation about, and then we'll dive into the before and the after and all of that kind of stuff.
Cool. I'm going to start with my 50th birthday, which was, now my brain's not what it used to be thanks to what I'm about to tell you happened to me some 14 months ago. But I remember turning 50 less than 2 years ago, and a mate of mine said, oh, you know, how are you feeling about 50 and everything? And I said, mate, I'm just getting started. I was cold plunging multiple times a week. I was, you know, doing breath work, into the Wim Hof stuff, fit, strong, mountain biking, all sorts of things. And so what happened in November 2024 was I'd been through, or I was in the midst of, a particularly stressful period in my life. I was chatting to you before we hit record, Matty, about the birth of my son, who's now sort of 2.5 years old. Unfortunately, his birth was quite traumatic for him, firstly, but also for his mother and for our whole family. And it was touch and go for the first few days of his life. And so that put a lot of pressure on our family. You know, you can imagine as a new dad what it's like to have your first child not okay from the moment they appear on the planet. And then subsequently coming home, you know, there's not a lot of sleep and lots of stress and everything. Both my wife and I had our own businesses at that stage. I was a world famous international coach of fame, as you pointed out. That's the arrogant version, but, you know, very busy business in the coaching space, which, as you know, Matty, is a lot of work. You're dealing with lots of people and lots of other people's stuff. And so my wife had literally sent me away at the end of November 2024 for a bit of a bloke's weekend away, racing my mountain bike at an event. And I went away by myself. I was stressed when I drove out the driveway. I remember not even waving to her and my 14-month-old son at that stage because I was running late and I was cranky, and that was just kind of – that's how my life was rolling, you know. And so I went to this mountain bike event, and I did the first morning of the event, did a couple of good runs on my bike, and I was going down for one last run before lunchtime, always famous last words for mountain bikers and skiers and everything. It's like, oh, one last run. And I was about three quarters of the way down that run on a Saturday morning, and a 16-year-old who came down on his run a couple of minutes behind me found me face down in the dirt, non-responsive. And so he raised the alarm. Fortunately for me, there were a lot of very highly skilled medical volunteers on site for this big mountain bike event, expecting spinal injuries and broken collarbones and femurs and all sorts of stuff. And instead they found a 51-year-old, I'm just trying to think how old I was, 51-year-old guy with no pulse and basically just about to let go of life. So wow. I had what's called an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and they figured out later a massive, massive heart attack that was combined with that. And so the medical staff worked on me. One lady in particular performed CPR on me. It took them 15 minutes to get a pulse. And then the medical team had to intubate me and do all sorts of emergency medical procedures, get me on a stretcher, carry me through the bush off the side of a mountain to get me to a troop carrier, which then had to drive me to the nearest spot where they could get the rescue chopper into, and then fly me to the hospital some 45 minutes to an hour away. And I was critical and unstable is the technical term for that. Unbeknownst to my wife, who didn't get any notification because nobody knew who I was. No one spoke to my mates. They didn't check my phone. So I went into hospital as Sierra Juliet was my code name that they give you when they don't know who the hell you are. So I was this unknown guy that just turned up at hospital clinging by his fingernails to life. Wow. So that's what happened to me. And then from there, you know, there was a lot of there was a bit of misadventure in hospital, and unfortunately, you know, these sorts of things carry a lot of risk with ICU and emergency admissions, and so it took them some time to figure out what was actually going on for me. They didn't know if I'd hit a tree and was suffering internal injuries or not, if it was just the blockage of my main cardiac artery. And so it took a while for all of that to get figured out. There was a bit of an accident with one of the procedures, and they lost me again in theatre and had to perform another emergency surgery and try and find out where the bleeding was from. And I've had lots and lots and lots of blood transfusions. Anyway, they finally got me stabilised after a few days. And then I spent 10 days in a coma, and when I woke up I'd had several strokes. And so I actually woke up unable to speak. I had full left side body deficit, body paralysis. And my wife, unfortunately or fortunately, is an occupational therapist who has worked on stroke wards and has a family member who's got a traumatic brain injury. And she's got a 14-month-old son who was still breastfeeding at that stage. The hospital's 3 hours from our home. And so, you know, it was a bit of a horrendous time for her, and I always smack myself when her and I grate on each other, which is natural for lifelong relationships. And when I tell this story, I think, man, I need to be kinder to my wife because she went through absolute hell through all of that. So as I said, Maddie, I'm prone to long stories, but it's hard to make this one short because much involved.
I'm with you on the journey. Like, that's And it happened again on the table, and oh man.
Yeah, yeah. So 19 days in hospital. I think it was like 15 of those in ICU. During that time, I, as I said, had a few strokes and a brain bleed. I had sepsis. I had pneumonia, an acute kidney injury. Like, it's just, you get the whole set when you're that unwell from an emergency perspective, you tend to be quite weak and, you know, you end up with a bunch of other stuff. Obviously, when I woke up, I wasn't in a very good way. I'd lost nearly 10 kilos of my 74 kilo body weight. In those sort of 14 days, and I was very, very weak. I couldn't walk. I couldn't get out of bed. I was so weak. And prior to that, I was a, like, I've been a CrossFitter for 10 plus years, a mountain biker, you know, hiking in the wilderness, carrying a 20 kilo pack. Like, I'm only a little guy, 5'7" and 74 kilos, but I've always been very strong and incredible work capacity. And, but my attitude to life and everything has always just been to keep pushing and push my way through. You know, in business, it's like, well, I just got to keep pushing and I just got to find a way to get more clients and I've got to find a way to get more results and I've got to find a way to reduce the stress and help our son. And it's just always, you know, get caught up in that whole thing. And ironically, that's what actually killed me, was just that pushing. And the specialists have said that I don't have heart disease. I'm a non-smoker, non-drinker. And it was most likely just inflammation caused by chronic stress.
Yeah, wow. I'm curious. I definitely want to get into the conversation around stress and the way that men manage their mind and stuff like that. But whilst we're still in the hospital conversation, like in that 19 days, like how many days of that were you conscious? Or did you wake up to actually realize what was going on?
So 10 days in a coma. So basically I was admitted on the 30th of November. And I was on life support and in a coma for 10 days after that. And even after they woke me up, I didn't wake up very well, which is what caused them to do some more investigations. I had brain MRIs and they're like, oh, whoa, he's had three strokes, and a brain bleed and he's not really okay. And so they didn't know what life was going to look like for me. It was one of those stories where it's like, yeah, we saved his life, but we don't know if he's going to wake up. And he's kind of waking up, but we don't know if he's going to be able to talk, walk, recognize his family. And so my wife went through all of that, sitting bedside, just waiting for her husband and the father of her infant son to hopefully wake up and be able to say, hey, honey, I've missed you. Except I woke up going, what? Because I have absolutely no recollection of anything other than dropping in for that last run on the Saturday morning on my mountain bike.
Wow. I was just about to ask you what the memory was like. So, and you still, nothing?
Nothing practical. I had some interesting experiences that I believe were spiritual experiences, which is quite common to a lot of, near-death experience survivors. But I have no recollection of any of the treatment. I missed out on the chopper ride. I love choppers, so I was really bummed about that because I did get a PR on Strava.
We can book you one.
but I have no recollection of that. I do vaguely recall being taken off life support and being what they call extubated. It's all a bit yuck for people, so I won't go into details. But, you know, they take you off the ventilator and pull out some of the tubes and stuff. So I do vaguely recall that. Not a fun experience. And then basically my first recollections are kind of seeing my wife and recognizing her face and then starting to be told where I am and why I'm here. And it was like, you know, you have these things, I think it's called cognitive dissonance. It's a technical term, but it's like somebody tells you something, you go, what? Hang on. No, say that again. And it was kind of like that, where it's like, the world is flat. It really is. I'm like, no. I've seen it from a plane. It's not flat. And they're like, no, it is. And that's how I was lying in bed with my wife trying to help me grasp what the heck was going on. Why was I hooked up to all these wires and why couldn't I move my body and why couldn't I get out of bed? And so it just felt really abstract. And honestly, Maddie, it still does some 14, 15 months later, where I tell this story and I feel like I'm telling a story about somebody else. It doesn't feel like I'm telling a story about me, despite having a massive scar up the front of my body where they had to, you know, open me up to try and find the bleeding that was taking my life a second time and all sorts of crazy stuff. It's really wild. But from about, 12, 13 days into my hospital stay, the last 4 or 5 days I was conscious and lucid and able to complain about everything and, you know, be miserable about being in hospital and just want to get the hell home, you know. It's like, I got to get out of here. I got to get home to my family. And so, you know, as soon as I was conscious, I literally started doing exercises in my bed. You know, I was flexing my toes. That was all I could do. And because I was paralyzed down my left side, I couldn't lift my left hand to my nose. And so I would spend half an hour like staring at my left index finger in bed and just trying to get my arm off the bed. And I just used to do that all day, every day. And after 19 days, I was discharged home with my wife. My wife and a good mate of mine stuck me in a wheelchair, wheeled me across the road to a cafe. I said, I want a decent coffee. And I got up out of the chair and I walked to the cafe table inside, sat down, had a coffee, and then I flopped into the car and they drove me home.
Yeah, wow. That's and so you're in a wheelchair. So at what point did you went from bending the toes, at what point did the feet start working, did the legs start working, did you get that hand to your nose?
Yep. So it took several days of just trying to get the muscles to work again, trying to get my brain to talk to my body again. And basically it's neuroplasticity. So trying to tap into that capacity that we all have, even in our 50s, 60s, to reroute some of those neurological signals and use areas of the brain that are currently just sitting there idle and recruit them for different functions. And so I started reading articles, research articles online, and, you know, my wife was finding me stuff and just looking at, okay, well, what are some of the ways I can actually change this? And that, I guess you could say I became obsessed with my recovery because I wanted to get back to how I was before. That's not going to happen for me. But that sort of focus was, okay, how do I do this? So I think it was, you know, maybe day 3 or 4 after they woke me up, I was able to lift my hand up, but I couldn't coordinate myself enough to touch the end of my nose with my finger. I couldn't even put my own glasses on, my reading glasses. I had to like pick them up with my right hand and unfold them with my mouth to be able to put them on my face because I couldn't coordinate my left fingers to do any of that stuff. And so I came home with a lot of those deficits. And just continue to work on that after, like, for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Was there a fear that those deficits wouldn't recover at all?
Oh, 100%. I was absolutely terrified that I would have these lifelong disabilities.
Yeah.
Which, ironically, my wife is an occupational therapist and has her own private practice, and her team work with people with lifelong disabilities. And so, you know, scary for me because I am familiar with some of the stories of her clients, scary for her because she's seen stroke victims and what their life now looks like with adaptive equipment and, you know, full-time supports and care and all that sort of stuff. And as most of the doctors and medical team would say to me, it's like, oh, you're so young. I'm thinking, young? I'm 51. It doesn't feel young at the moment. I'm stuck in a hospital bed and I can't walk without, you know, two orderlies like grabbing me under the arms and shuffling me off down the corridor. So, yeah, pretty confronting coming home with a walking frame and a toilet chair and a shower chair and not able to – I couldn't even whisk some eggs in a bowl to make an omelette.
Yeah.
I couldn't pick the pan up because it was too heavy. So, it was incredibly scary and the psychological journey has been a big one.
And your missus was probably like, I got with such a strong, fit whippersnapper to not bring work home with me.
this was supposed to be like, you know, personal life and work life were separate. Yeah. I was going to live to 100. You know, I used to be a bit cocky, actually. So I think in a lot of ways this has been about me learning some lessons that needed to be learned.
You said before that there was some spiritual-like experiences which are not necessarily unique to NDEs. Like a lot of people that have had near-death experiences talk about this. Can you, if you're open to it, just talk us through what you kind of experienced or remember or went through there?
Yeah, mine came in the form of people visiting me. not in the hospital, like it wasn't properly situationally correct. I was kind of in a hospital, but I wasn't in that hospital, and the surroundings were a bit different. And something that really stands out for me, and that I've shared with a few people, close friends and family that I've talked to about this, and now, you know, a whole bunch of people that I've never met on your podcast, is so some people really close to me in my life, you know, my late father and my wife, my infant son, my estranged daughter, my brother's kids, so my niece and nephew, they came to visit me, but nobody would make eye contact with me. Mm-hmm. So it was more a sense that I knew they were there, but they weren't interacting with me. Right. And there was some really quite trippy stuff that were visions that I recall, but they're not visions like, you know, you see a beautiful gorge on your international trip and you can remember the picture of that in your mind. You know, if you've been to the Grand Canyon, you can kind of recall what the Grand Canyon looked like and where you landed in the helicopter and sipped champagne and did all that sort of stuff. It's not something I can recall like that where it's a picture. It's more a feeling or a sense that those people, in inverted commas, were there, but we weren't in the physical realm. And, you know, my father was with me, but, you know, he passed back in 2020. And so there's no way he came and visited me in hospital. Mm. But there was somebody else that I distinctly recall listening to speaking with others in the hospital, and you know, I was familiar with this woman's voice, and I had this whole scenario of what had happened, and it really quite it shocked me and rocked me when my wife said to me, there was a lady across the corridor from my bed that passed away while I was in a coma. She came and went while I was unconscious.
Wow.
And so it gives me goosebumps even now just thinking about that, the possibilities, I guess, Maddie, around, you know, I can't explain it. There's no fact-based proof or evidence of anything. And it feels distinctly like some sort of other realm experience where I've been connected to people both living and dead that I never had any association with physically during that time.
Has it changed your perception or understanding or beliefs about what exists in the ether, the universe, or anything like that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a middle-aged white boy from Queensland who's had a traditional education in a traditional family, and so I've been in business for, 30 years, and so I'm probably defined, or I used to be defined a lot by what I know or what I think I know. And so what a lot of that has, I have a bit of trouble with word finding. But anyway, what that's brought about for me is, I guess, a lesson to stay open to possibilities more than I claimed I was before. And I do have a belief now that we are all connected in a way that isn't really described by some of the traditional ways that I've probably seen over the years. I'm trying to be, you know, polite and apolitical and
be as which is impossible as you for me.
And so, you know, I think a lot of different cultures have their own belief about who God is and who the creator is and where energy comes from and all that sort of stuff. And I think it's probably a lot simpler than religion makes out. I think it's a lot more accessible than a lot of spiritual leaders and teachers would have us believe. I don't think we need to actually do anything or practice anything to be spiritual. I think it's actually a choice and an openness to be spiritual. Mm-hmm. And as part of my recovery, I tried everything. I was doing visualizations from Joe Dispenza in the US. I was meditating. I saw a Reiki therapist. I saw an energy healer. I had my numerology done. I was just like, just give me everything. I'll just, let's open all the channels. You know, I'm not just going to have TikTok videos. I'm going to go all of the platforms and all of the creators and influencers, and I'm just going to see what actually sticks.
Yeah.
And so I can't tell you if any one of those actually was part of my miraculous recovery. And I don't actually care. And I think that's kind of the point, you know, being open to the energy of the universe and the healing power. Honestly, Maddie, and this is going to sound, actually, I don't care how it sounds, the power of love to heal.
Mm-hmm.
The power of love to heal anything and everything.
Yeah.
I believe that is actually that the essence of what my experience was, is I felt the love from those people in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
I've been surrounded by love since I woke up, and I continue to strive for, and it's a practice. I don't always get it right. Mm-hmm. I strive to be, as my wife jokingly refers to me sometimes now, is Mr. Love. You know, with our son, with my wife, with my family, friends, people in the street, whoever it is just always coming back to, how can I actually be the essence of love in this interaction?
Mm, that's a beautiful perspective. And what it makes me think of is state-altering, you know, plants and mushrooms and MDMA and that kind of stuff, which is now being used therapeutically but has been used sort of behind the scenes for thousands of years, especially mushrooms and ayahuasca. And the one thing, I've been on several shamanic retreats with mushrooms, and, yeah, one of the things that everybody talks about at some point is just the overwhelming sense of love and gratitude and beauty and just the breaking down of judgment and walls. And so not that that's quite a near-death experience, but it feels like on some level it's like tapping into that realm or that energy on some level of just like infinite love, you know.
And I believe that's there. It's like an underground river that runs beneath all of our feet every day. And most of us are wearing such ridiculous footwear that we just can't even feel it. So take off the Crocs and
take them off anyway.
I know they're terrible for your feet and your hips and everything else, but it's there, you know. It's there if we allow ourselves to believe it and access it, and as corny as it sounds, Maddie, my death and rebirth, which is what it was for me and for my family, has honestly been the best thing that ever happened to me and the best thing that ever happened to my family.
Mm, what makes you say
that? The path that I was on prior to that was not a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a path of, well, I talked about the stress, and that. So I see a lot of people who are very stressed in the world, and I had a 20-year coaching career. And I'm sure you see similar stuff, Maddie, in your niche, is a lot of people are very affected by the lives that they're living, mm-hmm. and the world that we live in. But as Westerners, we have so much choice about how we live our lives and what we're exposed to and what our life looks like. That stress for each of us shows up differently. It manifests itself in individual ways, whether that's a cardiac arrest and a massive heart attack and strokes, or cancer, or an autoimmune disease, or an alcohol addiction, or a food addiction, diabetes, type 2, whatever it is that shows up. So many of those things, I believe, and this is just my personal opinion, I believe they are the manifestation of the stress or the dis-ease in our lives. We are not at ease. We're not balanced. We're out of touch with that creative energy and our own potential. And therefore it comes out as something destructive, basically. Mm-hmm. And so mine was, you know, that catastrophic event that has actually bumped me onto a very, very different path in life, even though I look like very much the same guy as I was 2 years ago externally, people that talk to me that know me well know that I've changed.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, also with a young family over here, you know, there's a lot to be stressed about in the sense that the economy's not the one that I grew up in. Probably the same for you, right? And so the financial situation is stressful, and then there's all of this social media everywhere. So we're getting bombarded, all of us, when we doom scroll, with 1,000 different ways that you could be doing life better that you're not doing, so that you could have a family or a life that looks like this Instagram, you know? And it's so like, it's almost like pulverizing, trying to push you down. Like, and just it reminds me of that whack-a-mole, you know.
Yep.
It's like every time you see something, you're not up to, your business isn't up to scratch, your body's not up to scratch, your relationship's not up to scratch, your parenting's not up to scratch, and it's just this constant scrolling. And then, like you said, we're either stressed or we're depressed in some way, and then we try and soothe that or elevate that feeling with food or alcohol or, you know, insert substance or binge whatever. And so I'm curious, like, where do you think we get it wrong? Do you think we get sucked into a world that is intentionally designed to distract and stress us out? Or do you think that we're just choosing incorrectly?
Have you got a roll of aluminium foil handy, mate? Because you should fashion up a tin foil hat right now.
You are on the right podcast for that conversation.
I've actually been asked a few times by people, because it was cardiac related, they wanted to know if I'd had the COVID vaccine.
Reasonable question, in my opinion.
Yeah. And perhaps sadly, no, I hadn't, and I haven't. So I can't blame that, which actually means the only thing I can blame really is my own choices. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, sure, I think that there is an element of design to the society that we live in, to a point, but we're all complicit or implicit, complicit. I think it's complicit in, you know, we're all members of society. We're all actually a part of the machine that we love to hate. And so by scrolling, we're actually keeping the cogs turning. And so those micro choices, by buying shit food from the supermarket, which is not food, we shouldn't actually be calling it food, but by buying processed crap from the supermarket, we're actually keeping the wheels turning for those companies and for the marketing organizations and for that part of government that is making decisions based on people's behaviors. I think it's a positive feedback loop, even though it's a negative thing. It's like we keep buying the stuff, we keep scrolling, we keep buying shit online. And so the companies keep doing more things and go, well, people keep doing it, so we're going to keep doing it. And we're like, yeah, but you keep doing it, so that's why I keep doing it. And we just keep having this backwards and forwards positive feedback loop where until somebody or enough people go, you know what? No, I'm not going to be part of that. That'll shift the energy. But at the moment, the energy is very much around people allowing themselves to be unconscious about their purchasing decisions, about their food choices, about their parenting, about their relationships, about their employment. People are very unconscious, and my belief is that we have become so unconscious and disconnected from the reality of ourselves that just leaves us open to powerful, intelligent people to take advantage of that. Humanity has demonstrated that propensity for millennia, for thousands and thousands of years. Ever since humans have been walking around, we've been taking advantage of each other for our own gain. You know, one tribe went and whacked the other tribe to steal their hunting grounds or their women or whatever the heck, you know, like they had a bigger cave than we did. So we went and, you know, attacked them to get their cave. Like that's human nature. It's competition.
Yeah.
It just looks different now in 2026 than it did whenever we first started walking around, whether it was Adam's rib or whether it was evolution. It doesn't really matter. The human race has a pretty shit track record for taking care of each other.
Yeah. Totally agree. And on some level, that's like almost an argument to have family, because it's like they're often the only people that have your back or that you care about enough to make better choices. And this is something that I've really noticed, and I talked about it on a podcast recently, but, you know, with Gabriel, our son, coming into the world, it's like the way that I've interpreted that event is like such a call to arms to embody the things that I say that are important rather than just saying they're important, you know, and feeling like, shit, I've got to be a role model. But in the absence of familial connection or, you know, having kids. It's like, what is calling you to arms? You know, what is demanding you to actually prioritize care, be conscious, figure out how to manage your stress? And the interesting thing too is that I don't know about how you're framing it now, but I also feel like as a business owner and being a man and a new dad, I'm also, there's so much content online, which in many respects I agree with, of like moving away from the era of, you know, being the men that are emotionally vulnerable and do all this healing and, you know, are very feminine in the way that they navigate themselves. And now there's this sort of call to, you know, fuck that, man up, level up, alpha dog kind of energy. But then also some of that alpha dog energy is like, if I'm thinking about Alex Hormozy right now. Take on more suffering, suffer harder. You know, if you can't suffer, you lose, you know? And so it's like, how do we, like, where were you before with the way that you thought about executing your goals, your vision, your business, your parenting, all of that? And where are you now? Like, how did that thinking about how to manage all of that change?
So I was a nice guy. I was a timid, people pleasing, don't upset the boat, don't rock the boat kind of guy for decades. I'd been through some pretty ordinary relationship experiences and business relationships and had started to get more into the I need to be more of the alpha dog thing, but without being an asshole and still loving people, but also taking care of myself. And it's exactly as you said, it's like, where the friggin' hell is the harmony here? Like, what's the optimal balance of alpha dog, nice guy, emotional dude who cries, but also doesn't take shit from people and stands up for himself? And I think that in itself actually stressed me out so much because every day, particularly with social media, and I was very much like you as a coach, as an online educator, and I guess, you know, kind of an influencer, everything was crafted. Mm-hmm. Every time I opened my mouth, it was like, oh shit. Who am I talking to? How should I say this? How is this going to be perceived? What's that going to do to their perception of me and my business and reputation, therefore my family's livelihood? And so there was actually, I lost the ability to be myself. And so part of this whole thing for me, Maddie, has been figuring out who the fuck am I? Like, Warwick Bidwell died and, you know, I'm still here. I have the same driver's license and thumbprint, but I don't feel like I'm actually that guy anymore, even though I'm obviously the sum of my previous 51 years of experience in life. Yeah. And so I did a lot of work with a psychologist to figure out, well, I actually have an opportunity here to craft a person based on something other than what other people think I should be doing and serving others. I'm still driven to serve others, but not in a self-destructive or self, you know, putting self secondary way. So I spent 6 months of my early stage recovery also working with a clinical psychologist to build some behaviors and a life that allowed me to make values-based choices. Right. Whether that was the food that I put in my mouth, the holidays that I went on, my decisions around my recovery and my business and all sorts of stuff. It was like, okay, well, what are my values? And I was really clear on my values when I came out of a coma. It's like, what were the top three? Time with my family, my health, ironically, or perhaps not so, and life experiences. Mm-hmm. And I had two guys who sort of showed themselves as being greater friends than I'd ever realized. I'm not the sort of guy who's had a lot of mates in my life. Lots of connections and you know, associates and stuff. Gone and done cool stuff with quote unquote mates, but I've never had a best mate. I've never had someone who I'd ring up and say, hey dude, I'm really hurting, you know? And I think that's probably common for a lot of guys my age, 50 something, and perhaps other generations as well. But after my thing, like there were dudes that family man, business owners from, you know, other states in Australia. I'm in Tassie, who just literally dropped everything, put their lives on hold, jumped on a plane and came down here to drive my wife to and from the hospital, to come and hang out at home so that, you know, my family weren't on their own, come and sit bedside with me. Had a couple of mates who came into ICU, they've seen me, you know, literally in pieces, in a bed, and it shook them up a lot. And I was really taken aback because, like, oh, I've got really good friends, like really, really close friends. And one of those guys is just stuck, and we're like, you know, literally brothers from another mother, and we love each other and we talk to each other all the time. And he's been down a couple of times to visit me during my recovery, and that's been a fascinating new thing that's come out of this. And so that's a value for me. And I guess the things that were really important to me, there was nothing about money, houses. I couldn't give a shit. I couldn't care less if we went and lived in a caravan somewhere in a you know, caravan park. So long as I had my family with me and we loved each other and we were healthy, wealthy, in inverted commas, happy and strong, to borrow from someone else online, that was all that mattered to me. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, each of those words, you can have your own definition within that. But for me, it was like I didn't need a flash car. I didn't need to be the number one, you know, business coach in my field or anything. I could not give a flying flip about any of that stuff.
And out of curiosity, or in comparison, what do you think, or do you know what your values were before this happened?
I said they were the same things.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Because, you know, you've been coaching for a while, Maddie, and you sat through a bunch of the same stuff and worked with some of the same mentors and thought leaders in the space that I have over the years. And so I used to write lots of stuff, and I had an intentions board, and I'd figure out my values every year and do all the things, and I meant it when I did it. But after having this experience, it's like, I wasn't tapped into that. I wasn't tapped into, you know, our creator, to whatever you want to call great spirit, God. I don't care, right? I was doing it from a pragmatics point of view. It was a man way. I was doing it the man way. It's like, if I put this with this as this, I get this. Mm-hmm. And so it was always outcome focused. It was never just doing it because it was important to do it that way. Mm. And so now it's like, you know, my wife and I sit down and talk about even team members in her business. You know, she bounces a few things off me. I don't work anymore. I can't work because of some of the lasting damage from what happened. But you know, I'm still very functional and able to give her some feedback in her business. And so when she employs somebody, she literally does a bit of an audit on what does she think their values are personally, and how does that align with our values personally? Not business values, not some shit on a wall in a boardroom, but like, she's got to work with these people and, you know, have a relationship with them.
Yeah.
And so that's how it drives our decisions in different ways, you know, friends that we associate with, events that we go to, instead of feeling that pressure, you know, we go back to the stress thing we were talking about before. I live in regional Tasmania, so it's easier for me to be disconnected, which suits me just fine. But, you know, for many people listening to this, they're probably living in urban or semi-urban areas. And I've seen a lot of my clients over the years, their lives are just stacked. You know, there's social engagements and family gatherings, and then the kids have got activities like six times a week, and then there's school stuff, and then there's all these different groups of friends that you know in different settings that you've got to catch up with and make sure they're all taken care of. And then, you know, apparently we're supposed to be ice bathing every day and going to yoga six times a day and, you know, and meditating and listening to podcasts and reading books and going to self-development courses. Oh, and by the way, I've also got a job, so I've got to do that 4 days a week. And like, it just becomes absolutely manic. And I don't think many people ever step back and go, hang on, what is truly important to me in my life? Mm. When I woke up and realized that I'd almost put a full stop at the end of my life at 51, you know, 1973 to 2024, that would have been carved on the headstone or whatever, right? That was really, that's still quite shocking to me, to think that that could have been how I finished my life on this planet.
Yeah.
Was, you know, the way I was with my family, where everything was like high pressure, high stress, rushing, you know. It was like, even when we went away for a camping trip on a weekend, you know, I was storming around the yard, getting everything ready because I didn't have time and I had to do this last minute meeting. So I made sure that we got some more clients so that I could try and hit the next financial target so that I could, you know, make sure my wife didn't have to work full time because we've got a young son, and all this stuff just became so intense that even going away for what was meant to be a beautiful, connected family camping trip just became a thing that I wanted to do because I wanted to go camping. And deep down, I really want my son to be connected to nature and have these beautiful experiences. But I allowed it to get turned into another friggin' Instagram story in theory, you know? Whereas now I don't even post to social media anymore. I don't need to because I'm not in that business world. But it's actually really quite interesting to see the shit that people post. And it's not shit. It's their personal life. But I think, who are you putting this on Instagram for? Because all that's really happening is Meta is checking that out and deciding what content to serve up to you so that you keep buying stuff.
Yeah.
That's the cynic's view.
Oh, totally. Well, the other thing that I was going to say is, and this is a total side note to our conversation, but it's something that I have been like talking to people about, but it's like, and also like, who wants their children and their grandkids to grow up in a generation where they've got phones in their face and they have to, like, there's phones around their house, like, you know, because we've got a young baby, that a lot of our content is baby related because the algorithm, right? And it's like these children are being raised in environments where there's 10 cameras on at all times around the house, or they have to actually perform, because everybody that's been on Instagram knows half the shit on there is not captured naturally. Like, no. you might think it's captured organically and naturally, and it's like, oh my God, look at this 2-year-old that can do this thing. And it's like, hang on, get the director's view on what just happened. There's cameras, there's setups, there's no Timmy, do it again, Timmy. Like
3 hours of production to try and get that one take.
And I'm like, how cooked are these kids' brains going to be that they've been performing since they were one? You know, their lives are filmed. They're, you know, there's a phone in their face. Anyway, random tangent, but it's like that idea of a curated life is actually, well, it reminds me of, I think it's Ellen DeGeneres's DJ. His family was like the most perfect Instagram family, millions of followers, and he committed suicide. So like I've got this ridiculous theory. It's like the more perfect your family is on Instagram, the more miserable everybody is. Something happened in the weight loss world recently, and I want to talk about it because all of a sudden it seems like the answer to every struggle with food, every craving, every chocolate binge or weight loss plateau is apparently putting needles in your stomach. And honestly, I mostly get it because I too am a human being. Because if you've spent 10, 20, 30 years trying everything, being told it's your fault, that you're weak, or being handed another meal plan that doesn't really work, of course, things like Ozempic and other weight loss drugs or even weight loss surgery start to look pretty appealing. And I'm not judging anyone who's made those choices, not for a second, but I am judging the industry that got us here. Because what nobody seems to be discussing or bringing up is what happens when you stop. What happens to your metabolism, to your hunger signals, to your weight, to the muscle mass that you lose, to your relationship with food that was already complicated before you walked down this path, right? Here's what I know after years of working with emotional and binge eaters. The craving isn't the problem. It's a signal, and signals have causes. They might be blood sugar crashes, they might be stress and cortisol, it might be emotional patterns that got hardwired a long time ago from convenience as a result of a chaotic life or in some instances trauma. Inside my Real Weight Loss program, I actually ran a trial group specifically looking at natural alternatives to weight loss medication. And the results genuinely surprised me because people started experiencing that stubborn weight that they hadn't been able to shift for a very long time start to move. But more than that, was the constant food noise in people's heads. That relentless mental chatter and thinking and obsessing about food and managing yourself around food. Will I, won't I, will I, won't I? That's what led me to MitoSync. It's the supplement stack I now recommend to virtually all of my clients, and I use it myself every day. There's no prescription required, no injection, no giving a drug company a permanent seat at your table. And what you can do is take the quiz at realweightlosscoach.com/foodnoise, and we can see if this supplement stack is the right fit for you. The link is down in the show notes below or the caption. Again, realweightlosscoach.com/foodnoise, or simply scroll down. The link is down there. Click it, find out for yourself. Natural first always is our passion and our mantra.
Yeah, I've read a lot of books. I lost the ability to read early on in my recovery, and I've always been a big reader and a very fast reader. Mm-hmm. And so I literally had to redevelop the ability to read books, which was maddening for me. But I have read a lot of great books during my last 14, 15 months of recovery. Many recommended to me by friends who I was just like, oh, my gosh, you read that book? Wow. Okay, cool. And just learning about other people through that. But some great books about exactly that. You know, the more perfect life appears to be, the more depression and anxiety that brings along with it. Mm-hmm. And it is apparently a real issue with society. I mean, we're seeing the highest rates of anxiety and depression of any time in human history. And we look at all of the, diagnoses of some of the issues for young people. It's frightening stuff. And so much of it is so easily avoidable and actually repairable.
I'm interested to elaborate on that idea, but specifically for men, because it seems like no matter how many awareness days there are or, you know, like conversations about the black dog or whatever it is, it still takes men to break, before they'll actually change. And thinking about the men in my own family, I'm thinking about myself, I'm thinking about all the blokes listening, all the husbands of the women that are listening. Like, what do you think men need to do to shift that without having a near-death experience?
Oh, Maddie, I have pondered this many, many, many times since my own almost demise, because I had mates who early on, you know, when there's a drama, very early on, everyone's on board with it and they're all, you know, everyone's there and they're outpourings of emotion and all that sort of stuff and offers to help. And, you know, I had some beautiful people come and support our family, both physically, financially and emotionally. And then I reckon it was probably around the 3-month mark, 10, 12 weeks, I came home, things gradually start to seem like they're getting back to normal. I can tell you there's nothing normal about life post near-death experience.
I bet.
But people just kind of get back to their lives because they're busy. They've got kids at school and they've got businesses or jobs and mortgages and all that sort of stuff. And so that takes precedence, which is totally cool. I'm not begrudging any of that change. But I had some mates early on who sat at my house here on my back deck and cited my experience and how jolting it had been for them and how they just realized that they were stressed out and working themselves like crazy and just so focused on all this external stuff that they weren't really taking care of themselves. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm so grateful that my suffering and my family's trauma could be a wake-up call and a preventative thing for somebody else. And sadly, I've watched all but one of those guys pretty much slide back into what they were doing before. Mm. That's what it looks like on the outside. I could be wrong. I don't talk to them as much as I have in the last year or so. And the one guy that him and I have stayed very, very, very close, I know he has made a lot of changes and there's been a lot of change within his family and his business life because he really did take it seriously and do something about it. So honestly, the short answer is I don't know, Maddie. I think there's so many people like me out there sharing our story and saying, you know, don't end up like me. Don't be a cardiac arrest survivor. Don't be a cancer survivor. Don't, you know, like alcoholism, whatever the heck the suffering is that some of us have experienced. It seems there's a lot of us saying, don't end up like me, but more people just keep ending up like us, despite the cautionary tales that are out there. And so I think it goes back to something you referenced earlier, which is at that societal level, I think there has to be a bigger shift in what society values, which is the collective of the individuals. I think it's going to take enough people to shift their values that will shift society's values, and in itself actually creates the healing energy for the individuals back the other way. You know, it's kind of that backwards and forwards action. I make less sense than I did before I had my arrest. So if that made absolutely no sense to you or your listeners, I apologize.
No, that makes sense. I'm just trying to think for myself because, like, we've kind of got kids in the same, you and I have both got kids that are, two and under.
Similar age,
Yeah, and so because the other thing that I feel personally as a man and as, like, the sole provider is, I wouldn't want my partner Yali to feel like Maddie can't provide the life that I want, whether it's things or like, to reference your values, like, life experiences, and life experiences cost money.
Some of them do. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them do.
And I'm going to refrain from coaching you, mate.
Totally. But like, I'm just, managing multiple people's lives, and you want to provide opportunity and it feels to me as a man that's, like, sort of at the helm here trying to make sure we don't drown all the time. It's like, the only way to produce a life everyone's happy with is to work myself to the bone, and so it's really hard to reframe that. And I'm wondering too, not that you necessarily have the answer to this, it's like, do the values of our loved ones change in the same moment because they realize that their desires and their wants were actually not important either in the face of losing the loved one? And so it's like maybe everybody's values change in that moment. So it's much easier to come off the back of that experience and be like, I'm not going to work myself to the bone because it turns out actually my partner just prioritizes me being alive now.
Yeah, I think you're bang on, Maddie. Again, personal opinion, no one has to agree with me or disagree. I think everybody is part of the problem. Gosh, that sounds like a line for a bloody coaching program. But, it's not just the dudes. Let's make it 2026. It's both partners in a couple's relationship. It's all members of the family that are part of this societal shift where men still appear to be saddled with this either self-imposed or, group-imposed ideal that they need to provide all this cool stuff and wonderful experiences and great life for their family. I don't think enough people are going, does it have to be a 2-week trip to Thailand? Is that the experience that's going to actually leave a mark on my family that I want to? Mm-hmm. Or could it be a camping trip at Byron for 4 days?
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a cynic and a skeptic, and that lived on after my near-death experience. In fact, it probably got bigger. I just always look at this stuff now and I think, who are you doing that for? Mm. Why do you need to post, why do you need to buy Foo Fighters tickets when you live in Adelaide and fly to Tasmania and stay in a hotel and go see some rock band that you could fucking listen to on Spotify for free? Like, who gives a shit? Now, if that's your jam and that's the experience you want to have, great. But if that's actually coming at the cost of some other value in your life because – that whole weekend experience cost you $4,000 to get your family down here and you had to work another 8 weeks of your life to pay for it and you're stressed out, you're an asshole for your family now because you're so stressed and tired that you actually don't have any of the love and emotion to give to your wife and your kids. What are they going to value more when you're 79 and your day is done? They're not going to give a toss about the concert you went to back in 2026.
Yeah, it's so true.
They're going to be saying, oh, my gosh, he was just such a loving dad. He was always there for us. He was fun. It didn't matter if it was pissing rain and we were making cubbies in the lounge room when I was 16 and just being stupid, or if we were camping together. Like, he was just such a fun dad and I'm going to miss him and I feel him in my heart versus, yeah, we had the best cars and we had the better holidays than anybody I know. Like, what's going to matter more to you? Now, I got that opportunity at 51 to wake up and look back on my life and go, oh, shit, I've been striving for the wrong stuff. Mm. I've been saying the right things, but I'm pretty sure I was doing it for the wrong long-term goals.
Yeah.
Now, I still live in a nice house and we drive nice cars and, you know, we'll take nice holidays and we do it mindfully and consciously by saying, does this align with our values? Mm-hmm. What mark is this going to leave on our family for the next 20, 30, 40 years? What is my son going to say when he's reminiscing about his late dad? What's he going to say about me? How's he going to feel about his childhood? I know how I feel about my childhood and my father, and it's not what I want for my son.
That's a good frame. Yeah, it's often how I think about Gabriel as well. I think like I want him to grow up thinking like dad's someone I want to be at least half like.
You know, I grew up wanting to be different to my dad.
Mm.
Now my dad worked his tail off. He provided, as he always used to say, put a roof over our head and food on our plate and clothes on our back, because he didn't have a lot of that stuff when he was a kid. So he was trying to do different to his dad, and my dad did different, but he was also a hard ass and he was critical and he wasn't emotionally available to us and he didn't cop any sadness or disappointment or anything from particularly me as the eldest son. And so when he took his own life in 2020, I just felt a huge hole of a relationship that I never had with my father. The one person in my life as a man that has the greatest impact on young men growing up. And so when I woke up from my event, it was like, oh, shit. And I remember telling my wife that I gotta change this. I gotta change. And so we literally sat down and figured out, well, what does that look like? And so that's what we're manifesting now.
Mm. Yeah. Man, that's the other part of being a man that, you know, happens for so many is that, and it's awful that it happened for your dad, but yeah, suicide, probably for many of the same reasons we're talking about, you know, the perception that of being a provider and what that means and the perception of taking all the responsibility and the trying to be all the things that the world thinks we should be. And it's, yeah. And what it makes me think of is more blokes need to get in person with one another, not to necessarily talk about their feelings, but just to do shit, like go for a hike. Like I love going to men's groups, but my experience of being a man is that most men open up in a blokey way to each other after you've done hard shit together. And that might be, you know, building a shed, that might be doing a workout together, that might be playing footy together, you know, in business. Sometimes it's like, you know, going to war in business or the sales, doing a bunch of sales together. And I think one of the things that's damaged all of society, but particularly blokes who, you know, struggle to open up or have emotional awareness as it is the lack of us being together in physical time and space where you can high five and hug and all that kind of stuff. Because I feel like that's where sometimes you don't even need to talk about it. Sometimes you just need to do shit with the boys, which isn't necessarily Thailand strippers and coke. It's like just doing stuff, you know.
Probably not the best, probably not the top of the list if we're going to actually look at social change, but hey.
So,
I've done some of those things with mates in the last 12 months. Like I'm physically pretty well now. I have permanent damage to my heart muscle and, you know, I've lost a decent amount of physical capacity. I've got some lasting brain damage from the strokes and the brain bleed that affect my life. Most people wouldn't notice or realize, you know, people look at me and go, oh, you got your WAS muscles back, and they assume that everything's all good. Obviously, I've worked damn hard to restore my physical health and well-being. But I've been able to physically do some things, just as you were talking about, Maddie, with a few mates. You know, I went and did a hike. It nearly broke me because I realized how much capacity I've lost since I had my arrest. But I managed to do an overnight hike with a mate of mine, and it was exactly that. You know, we busted our asses for 9 hours on the first day. I was like, oh, my gosh, I think I might have bitten off a bit more than I could chew for my first one back. And, you know, we got to the campsite at the end of the day. There was lots of silence. And then there was just, you know, little conversations about bits and pieces here and there that I know landed in a way for that guy that will probably stick as far as those micro choices that he makes through life. Yeah. I rode mountain bikes with another mate who I've known for 20 years, mostly through business, kind of like you, but a little bit closer. And, you know, he was down here, just happened to be down here on holidays, organized it so we could ride mountain bikes together for a couple of days. And I believe that the interactions we've had during and after that physical pursuit are going to change the trajectory of his life and especially his health. And so I absolutely agree with you, Maddie. I think two things, right? Here's my arrogant view about what the problem is and how to fix it as far as men and this whole provider thing and stress and, you know, causing illness for ourselves and our families. I think exactly as you've said, there's not enough of blokes doing bloke shit. Mm-hmm. You know, men are men, and that might be 80% of the male population are that way, and there's 20% where that doesn't work or fit, and that's totally, totally cool. I accept that. I have a two and a bit year old son. We have not stereotyped him or anything. He's had access to everything, and he loves trucks and helicopters and diggers and sand pits, and he likes, you know, running around with those shoes on and whacking the dog over the head with a stick, and like he's a boy.
Yeah.
Right? And so he needs to be able to express that. And I think as men, we don't express that anymore. You know, I get to do that through hiking and lifting weights in the gym and riding my mountain bike. And it's not drinking beer and farting and all that sort of stuff, but it's a yang pursuit, right? Mm-hmm. It's masculine energy. It's a hot energy. It's out there doing hard shit. And then I think, with the lack of that, I think a lot of men have stopped leading, and they don't say to their family, what the fuck are we going to Thailand again for? What is there for us? Now, again, Maddie, if that's someone's thing and that's your highest value is to go to Thailand and, you know, do an international holiday with your family, sure. But do it because you sat down and went, well, what do I value most in life, and how is this experience going to pay off for us over the next 20 or 30 years compared to some of the other available options? Mm. And what load does this place on me as the sole provider or as the house husband who's, you know, supporting the wife to go and have the high-paying career because that's the way the world works? But as a couple, those conversations need to be had. And I think men need to actually be leading those conversations and saying, hey, honey, how does this align with our values?
Mm.
Now, I don't think too many people are doing that.
No, I agree. I agree. I was just going to say, if this podcast ends, listeners, blame Warwick for this pep talk. Gonna move Manny's to the going,
holy shit, I need to change my life.
It's funny because what I noticed is when I started the business journey many years ago, I was sort of amidst my own healing and trauma recovery, blah, blah, blah. But when I sort of got to the other side, not that I think we arrive at healed, but, you know, mostly I'd sorted my shit out, I realized social media became really hard work because I no longer had a need within me to be seen by everyone and validated by everyone and loved by everyone. And so I was like, shit, I've started a business where I need to be famous to make lots of money, basically with the social media world. So I was like, but I don't really want to be famous anymore. And that's, I was right. Like, oh, shit, I need a new business.
Absolutely, mate. Growing tomatoes is quite rewarding, apparently.
Yes, we're doing that. We've got a little bit of that out the back.
Nice.
Anyway, mate, awesome. I'm glad you're here to talk about it. I'm glad you're here to tell this story, and I think a lot of people are going to get lots of value from this conversation. So thank you for having it. And now, before we wrap up, with every guest, we do a little sort of rapid fire, 6 questions to round it out. Based on the level and depth of this conversation, these are going to seem very trivial now, but we're going to do them anyway. So,
oh, I took notes, Maddie. I prepared for this.
I love it. All right, let's get into number one, which is, what's something you believe now that made you laugh 10 years ago?
Well, I thought about this, and I'm going to try and give you shorter answers. Given the nature of your podcast, the thing that made me laugh 10 years ago that I now believe is that plants are trying to kill us. and that you shouldn't eat them. There you go. That'll open a can of worms that no one's going to know where it came from.
That's juicy. What's one habit you'd be embarrassed to admit that you still have?
I could not come up with anything, Matty. The days of me being embarrassed about anything are gone since I spent so much time in hospital. I do have a weird thing, though. I have to go to bed with clean feet. So if my feet have touched the floor after my evening shower, I need to go and wash them again before I get into bed.
That is fascinating.
There's a blokey bloke habit for you.
What's one supplement habit or wellness trend you think is overhyped?
Oh, dude, the whole vegan thing, plant-based, I'm sorry.
Oh, based on your other comment, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
What's a rabbit hole topic you think more people should explore?
All right. I think everybody needs to dig into autonomic nervous system rebalancing and vagal nerve tone.
Good answer.
And ways to increase your vagal nerve tone.
In 20 years from now, what do you want to be known for?
Matty, I want to be known for the way I loved my family and friends.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. And our final one is, if everything you've ever said was deleted, what's one sentence that you want to leave people with?
All right. You ready, Matty?
I'm ready for profound. Hit me.
Life is uncertain. Live more now.
Live more now. Today, right now.
Absolutely, mate.
Thanks so much for being here, mate. I appreciate your time, your energy, and everything that you're about. So I'm glad we did this.
Me too. It's been fun. Thanks, Matty.
No worries. Thanks, Ross.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.